I'm John Perry, and this is Selected Prose.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Selected Prose. I've just learned that I am getting a dog, which I'm quite excited about. It's been many years since I had a dog. Rest in peace, Zoe. Died in May of 2018, I think. She was a good one. 17 years young. So I wanted to rescue one. Literally, if I could, maybe like in a dumpster or something. But my other half wanted to get a hypoallergenic miniature golden doodle. So I don't think you can really rescue those. I don't think people drop mini golden doodles off at the pound. So you might see me walking around Brooklyn with a mini golden doodle soon. Fits my character, I suppose. You know, it was really fun talking with Ellen Burkett Morris, whose book Lost Girls came out in the height of the pandemic in June of 2020, but we're going to be breathing some new life into it now that things are coming to an end. It's a great collection of short stories. Very Sherwood Anderson, small town oriented and funny and interesting and some very strange characters and just a pleasurable read throughout. That collection, Lost Girls, has been called a varied set of tales from a skilled practitioner of the short form. Her fiction has appeared in Shenandoah and the Antioch Review, Notre Dame Review, South Carolina Review, Santa Fe Literary Review, and other journals. She's the winner of the Bevel Summers Prize for Short Fiction, and she's also the recipient of the 2013 Al Smith Fellowship from the Kentucky Arts Council. Ellen called in from Kentucky, from Louisville. It's a wonderful city, by the way. I'd recommend checking it out if you haven't been. Go to the Evan Williams Distillery. Get drunk off some delicious bourbon. Walk around and read some historical plaques. It's a lot of fun. But it was a wonderful discussion. Specifically, we got into the nitty-gritty of a few things, like I'm often critiqued about the endings of my stories. I don't know how to end stories. I don't know how to end parties. I don't know how to end things in general. So Ellen helps us out with ending and therefore beginning. And we kind of dive deep into a few of her stories that utilize various techniques that we can all benefit from. Yeah, good time. Enjoy the pod. Shoot me an email if you have any ideas about what I should name my dog, whether it be a male or a female. Right now I was thinking female could be Fiona. Male could be Henry. Henry. So those are the two contenders. But if you have better ideas for a mini golden doodle, please let me know. All right, without further ado, here's Ellen Burkett Morris. Welcome. Thanks for coming on.
Oh, you bet. Glad to be here.
Yeah, it's great to meet you. Lovely Sunday morning, at least where I am. Great day to talk about writing. Where are you calling in from?
Louisville, Kentucky.
Kentucky? Oh, great. Yeah. I have a friend who lives in Louisville, so.
I might know them, but you can throw me their name and I'll see.
Zach and Barbara Ray Stegner.
Ah, okay. But it's Louisville's like a big small town, really.
Yeah, I've visited several times. It's a lot of fun. I think we went to the Evan Williams Museum, whiskey distillery and tasting, so that was great.
Yeah.
But thanks a lot for coming on. It's great to, I know this has been kind of a long time in the works, but it's great to finally have you.
Looking forward to it.
So, Lost Girls. It's your new book of short stories. Could you tell us a little bit about it? I've had the pleasure of reading it and I look forward to discussing that, but I'd like to hear just kind of some background.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, this thing began as a set of short stories that centered around a male photographer from Boston. And I had him traveling through the South at the time of the bicentennial and photographing people there in this small town. And, you know, really what I found is he was such a quiet character, and there wasn't enough of a draw with him. And the stories were really the stories of the women in the photographs that he was taking, you know. And so I had sent it around to some independent publishers, didn't get as much interest as I wanted. And then the Me Too movement happened, and I started to think about the importance of women's stories and realized that I had a body of work that really spoke to that. Not only the stories of women, but the stories of women across the range of a lifetime. So, you know, young women and older women. And so I pulled that photographer out of there for the most part, toned him down in some stories, and heightened the other stuff that I had in a way that really felt to me like it was a unified collection. And that's when I knew I had something to go on.
Yeah, that's a pretty interesting way to start a story, is through photography. You know, I have sometimes the feeling, right? You know, I've heard of authors who will be struck by a certain painting or something, and that informs the whole premise of their next work. And I've always thought that that's just an interesting way to start.
Well, you know, it was actually a writing prompt at the Kenyon Review Writers Workshop that got me started down this path. And in the picture, there was a woman, and she was standing in front of a window, and the light was coming in behind her in a sort of a halo fashion. And that's an image in the story, Kodachrome, about a young girl who is interested in seeing her colors and who actually takes her clothes off in front of a photographer, and he gets the shot of her framed by this window. And that all started at Kenyon probably 10 years ago, you know, with that prompt. So. Mm-hmm.
Did you go to Kenyon?
You know, I attended the summer workshop, I'll be honest, 5 or 6 times. You know?
Oh, great.
Yeah. It's a fantastic sort of a generative thing. So you go there with nothing, and they make you write while you're there, which is just absolutely set your hair on fire, you know, and you get up and you read in front of everybody. And I worked with Ron Carlson while I was there. I worked with the poet David Baker. You know, a lot of really good, really fine instructors, and really felt like being on it. It felt like being on an island full of writers, you know, because it's such a small town. So
that's so lovely and romantic. I grew up near Kenyon, and and it's such a beautiful campus. And obviously the writing program is phenomenal, and
it's well worth it for sure.
Yeah. So I'm curious about, you know, the genesis of the short story collection. Did you know right off the bat that you were going to make this into a collection, or were you just sort of?
I was writing with Link Stories in mind, with that photographer at the center of it. So I really was. I was kind of trying to do it, you know, do a Winesburg, Ohio, Elizabeth Strout deal on a small town in Kentucky. And so, yeah, I really had worked consistently towards that. But it was when I figured out that the women in the stories were central to it, that it had that overarching theme. And, you know, as I go around talking about the book and promoting the book, there's nothing more important really than having something that people can get their hands on. You know, they can understand what it is and what it's about. And this definitely has that. It has that central core.
Yeah, almost like an I hate to merge like business terminology with writing terminology, but almost like an elevator pitch where people are like, oh, okay.
Yeah. Hate to say it, but it's, yeah, people love it.
Yeah. Through this podcast, I've been learning that we all must promote.
I do promotion. I work for a feminist foundation, the Kentucky Foundation for Women. I do promotion. I've spent my life promoting other people's work. And so as hard as it is to do, I've enjoyed doing this. I've enjoyed trying to find an audience for this, you know.
It seems like you've succeeded. I was looking at your Goodreads page, and it really seemed your work seems to really have touched a lot of people, women in particular, but I think in the description or somebody left a review that said some men, and I really appreciated the quality of the writing. And I like that you brought up Winesburg, actually, because this idea of like a short story cycle where you get, you know, everything's subtly interconnected is very compelling.
Well, it is. And, you know, the thing with him, the thing that made me think of him is really that I think I had in my mind that he talked about grotesque. He talked about these characters who are sort of out there and strange in different ways. And I really thought that some of the female characters here were the same way. You know, I've got a woman in a story who is so lonely that when she wanders into a breastfeeders group, she decides to stay, you know. So these women have unique obsessions that make them a little bit off, a little bit different, you know. And then we've got the young girl who looks at like a Hustler magazine and notices the colors, not the nudity, but the colors, and wants to see her own color. So I love the idea of building characters around these sort of very peculiar obsessions and sort of seeing where that would go, especially since our idea of small town is that it's so placid and there's nothing going on there, you know, but really there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of stuff happening.
Obsession was certainly like a theme that I picked up on, which I admired. And I think Lost Girls is the name of the collection, but the title story is particularly strong, and it's about, you know, a kidnapping. And from what I understand, it's like the protagonist didn't really like know. It wasn't like a friend, right? This Dana person was kidnapped, and not a friend or anything, but this idea of being kidnapped then essentially consumes her.
Right, right. Yeah. In a way that you wouldn't expect. There's almost a tinge of envy in a way, because she doesn't really understand when she's younger what it means. Mm-hmm. And she notices the attention that the girl gets, the attention she doesn't get from her own parents. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so as she lives with this absence of this girl, she learns to sort of focus on honoring her in a unique way. And that was a story, you know, I wrote that as a dramatic monologue probably 15 years ago.
Oh, wow.
It's had staged readings. It had a staged reading at the Arnoff Center in Cincinnati. And, you know, and I think, like most really compelling stories, what it's got at the heart of it is a real contradiction. You know, we expect all sympathy or empathy from the girl, or we expect that she's going to be outwardly directed towards the girl who was taken. But she, like many of us, is just in her own head, worried about her own stuff, feeling a lot of complex, really unflattering emotions, you know? And so, you know, for me, in terms of developing stories that really work, part of it is giving myself permission to go to those places where you reveal, you know, the entirety of the character and not just the polite stuff, not just the stuff people want to see, but all of it. You know,
And it really struck me too. I mean, I think, you know, I want to talk to you specifically because it's something that I struggle with as a writer, but it's like ending short stories, right? Like, and you're really, I think that you're really good at it, but the way that Lost Girls, the story ends is every few years. And so this is, the protagonist is somebody like a young woman going through youth. And at the very end, you say, every few years I come here and leave something for Dana, tampons, an old set of car keys, a graduation cap. She'll be 21 this year. Tonight, I'll leave this bottle of Jack Daniels. By morning, it'll be gone. And it just felt like, you know, first of all, the progression of tampons, an old set of car keys, and a graduation cap is these, you know, these three like pinnacle moments in varying like phases of youth. And then, I don't know, it just felt like it ended on the right mark. And I am always like, I'm always getting letters from my peers and my professors who are like, great story, but the ending is, you know, it sucks. And I'm very curious about, you know, just if you could walk me through like maybe Lost Girls as an example of how you knew when it should end.
Right, right. And I will say that I'm teaching a class through Hidden Timber Books at the third weekend in April on story endings.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So I'll be teaching that for people who are curious, and you can find the information about that on the Hidden Timber Books website.
Oh, please send me this too. So when I write the description for the episode, I'll include it.
Absolutely. Will do. So, you know, all of that sort of, I think that story endings often come for me from objects. And, you know, this idea, I took a workshop with Ron Carlson, and he talked about populating your fictional world with an abundance of objects related to your character and the fact that they need to be really particular. So he said, if you have a Frisch's restaurant in the story and you have another one a mile down the road, they have to be very different. You know, you got to make sure they're distinct. So oftentimes what I'll find is that I gravitate towards objects as a linchpin for story endings. And so in that case, in that instance, she goes from the beginning, she's haunted by the disappearance. She's kind of in her own head. She's kind of dealing with her own stuff. Ultimately, though, she remembers, and she wants to find a visible way to mark that remembrance in the world. So she decides to settle on those objects. And then once I decided that she was going to leave something, I just went in through in my head, you know, what are those milestones? What are the milestones that girl would have missed? And what are the objects that represent those milestones? And then because I wanted it to have a little bit of a tone of defiance, you know, this, I'm going to have a toast, I'm leaving this bottle of whiskey. And mm-hmm. just like her, it's going to disappear by morning. You know, this mm-hmm. is what happens in our world. Things are here and then they disappear. So I think that's kind of, I hope I'm unpacking that. You know, I think some of it just happens unconsciously as mm-hmm. you're writing. But I do really find that for me, that's objects or images are good stopping places. So in the story, Religion, about the breastfeeders group, mm-hmm. I have her walk into a room and she notices these babies asleep in the corner. And at the end of the story, she has left the group and she has this memory of the small babies breastfeeding, the sun coming in the window, and I leave with the words "so hungry," which is exactly what she was, so hungry for mm-hmm. some sort of connection. So that really helps me if I can settle on kind of a central image to wrap things up. You know, it works for me, and also it speaks for itself, right? Like I don't have to say, I don't have to say anything about how that's ending. The image does the work for me. The image kind of wraps it up for me.
So that's very interesting that you're teaching a class on endings. I actually didn't know it was such a big problem for other people, but I'm sure, I guess, you know, it's a huge challenge.
Yeah, I think a lot of people struggle with it. I really think they do. And and then people like Flannery O'Connor say, oh, endings need to be surprising yet inevitable. And you're like, oh, well, the bar's just like right, you know, right high up in the sky. What am I going to do now?
Yeah, she's like, just do what I do. It's easy.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess you can't talk about endings without beginnings. But another, you know, obsession of writers is not only where do I start and the story I want to tell, but first line. Just a few I wanted to point out was your story in Life After. You know, the first sentence is, Jacobs wasn't the first death at Quarryside, right? That's such a hook. You know, how many drafts do you go through before where you're not really hooked by your own beginning and you're like, you know what, how does that work? How do you know when and where to start a story?
Oh gosh. Yeah.
That's a hard question, but
yeah, that is a really hard question. I don't know. I think for me, a good bit of the writing work happens in my head before I sit down.
Okay.
I've been working on novels here lately and oh my God, the agonizing, the working, the reworking, yeah. How did we begin this? How do we end this? But stories for me tend to come to me a little bit more easily, but partly I think because I'm doing that hard work. So mm-hmm. I live, like half a mile from a quarry swim club where I spend a lot of my days I start my days in the summer water walking through the water.
Oh, that sounds lovely.
Oh, it's incredible. It's really something else. And mm-hmm. and while I'm in there, I can imagine all kinds of life experiences and, you know, all, and of course, in a place like that, drownings are sort of legendary, you know, yeah. People remember them forever. And so I thought, well, I'm going to put myself in the head of this woman who loses her son. And then again, I'm not entirely sure what brought me to that particular first line, but I think it was in fact, this idea that, you know, you're going to hear about the ones that have happened. You're going to hear about the one that happened a long time ago, and you're going to hear about the one that happened more recently. And there's going to be a bit of a ghost mm-hmm. over the place. And so, and again, I think particularity is just a huge key. you know, that, and that you want to make it, this is going to sound so horrible, but you want to make it interesting, right? I mean, mm-hmm. you know, you read so many stories and people feel obligated to include like really kind of background, the material that, you know, doesn't thrust you into the story, that doesn't really serve the story, but they feel, you know, it's like, oh God, I've got to put that in there or else, you mm-hmm. know, oh, you know, Jacob drowned, blah, 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 you know, whatever. No. So you just, so it is a question. And I've heard Allison Williams, the Brevity blog editor, who's so fantastic, talk about, you know, the real challenges are knowing when to enter the story. You mm-hmm. know, she does a workshop and she talks about how, you know, figuring out when to enter the story. And so that's part of that challenge too. Mm-hmm. So you want to ask yourself, like, what, you know, what is the most interesting point of entry that I can have here? What's the most particular, mm-hmm. you know, what's the kind of thought that would haunt a mother? This wasn't the first drowning there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's really an exercise too in like radical empathy, trying to inhabit that, yeah, which is just what makes good writing in general. I think that's kind of like an essential ingredient that you're able to empathize.
Absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And God, it's painful when you're doing it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like,
no.
Oh man. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I kind of want to go back to what we were talking about earlier about, you know, both the workshop at Kenyon, but also your strategy for using images to kind of like inform.
Yeah.
Could you just maybe walk me through like a particular example of that, like how that works? And also I'm kind of curious about the lesson that, you know, how that lesson was taught at Kenyon, because I think it could be a really fun exercise for people who are maybe suffering with like writer's block or something to yeah. spend some time with an image and turn it into a story.
Yeah. And I'm not sure I have a sort of a particular exercise I could tell you about in terms of how to do that. But I would say if you pick up, I think it's Ron Carlson has a book that's called Ron Carlson Writes a Story. I think that's the title.
It's a very straightforward title.
Yeah. Because he will, you are sitting with him as he's doing it. And I think that's was what, you know, in addition to being in the room with him, and honest to God, he was like a mad genius. He was just spewing wisdom left and right. Reading that book really was the thing that put me in his process, where you populate a world with details and where you go off in these different directions. So I would say that would be a great place to start with that. Mm-hmm. And then I will have an exercise involved in the in that Hidden Timber class that I'm teaching.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Is that going to be on Zoom, or is it going to be an in-person sort
that'll
of?
That'll be on Zoom.
On Zoom. Okay.
Yeah. So
that's exciting.
Yeah, I'm excited about it. So in terms of how I did that in a story, so I've got the story Inheritance.
Mm-hmm. Another great opening, by the way.
Thank you. Yeah, some people are born to sin, others inherit it. I didn't know which of these I was until I crossed paths with the Cabots. So I've got a protagonist here who's oppressed by a rich mining family. And she goes in, she's going to perform a ritual called sin eating, which is an actual thing that happens. In the country, even today, where they place a corpse cake on the body of a dead person, and the person eats it, the sin eater eats it, and symbolically absorbs their sins.
Wow.
Incredible.
I had never heard of that.
My stepsister told me about it, and it went into the idea file, and I struggled. I had it for 10 years before I was able to figure out what to do with it. So in this story, so we find out that this young woman who's in there has been raped by the son of the woman who died.
Mm-hmm.
And she's been called in to eat the sin of that woman. So it's humiliation upon humiliation here that she has to deal with. And what I do with this story is that I'm talking about the, you know, you get the sense of the poverty of where she lives, of the opulence of where these people live. At one point, she looks out the window in front of this house, and she says, I looked out the window at the tall oak standing in front of the house. It was a huge old tree with a gnarled trunk. The thick branches came out like tentacles spreading towards the sun, taking up space against the sky. I saw a strong low branch, a perfect place to perch and watch the world, and I took took in the sturdy branches just beyond footholds to the sky. My son would never play there.
Mm.
Okay, so.
It's beautiful.
So she sees this tree, and this tree becomes, it's just a symbol of everything she knows her kid will never get to experience. So as the story goes on, she has to make some choices about, she wants to escape this life. She tries to escape the life. The coal mining, the son comes and finds her, drags her back to town. And so here I am making the hard choice. And again, I struggled with how to end this story, really struggled. And I'm just going to go ahead and give it away here. Yeah. So she returns to the oak. I'll start here. I climbed to a high branch. The face of the Cabot's house was silent. How surprised Daniel would be in the morning. How quickly word would spread among the neighbors. I'd seen my father hang pigs upside down to drain the blood plenty of times. I secured the rope, fashioned a noose, and placed it around my neck. I imagined my body swaying in the wind, a spectral figure in my dark cloak. The bees would still buzz, the river would flood, girls would get visited in the night, and the Cabots would sit counting their money, polishing their silver, with no idea of what had been taken from them. I let myself fall.
Wow.
So, the oak tree. You know, you plant it and then you use it, you mm-hmm. know, and it's a symbol of all these things. And it's also conveniently like a very public place for her to do this. So people will know there was a reason why she hung herself in front of his house. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not a coincidental thing. And so it's going to make a statement that will reverberate beyond, you know, her death.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, that to me was how that worked.
Is that one of your more favorite stories in your collection? Do you have like your babies that you're like, I like them all, but this one is.
I do, but I have to say religion is a big one for me.
Yeah.
You know, partly because it got published in the Antioch Review, which was a huge deal for me. And mm-hmm. and they said to me, you know, this is satire and we don't get a lot of satire and we like it and we're taking it.
Wow.
So. Wow. Yeah, he told me, he gave me the exact percent, the editor gave me the exact percentage of how slim, how hard it is to get in the journal. It was ridiculous.
Yeah.
And then it said, but I like this and we're taking it. So I like that one. I like it because it's funny and sad.
Yeah, and, right.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of hits all the notes there and it's kind of outrageous mm-hmm. as well. I also like how I miss not being a ballerina, which is a story about a couple young girls who are friends, you know, sad and kind of sweet and says a lot about sort of what women are taught to expect, you know, these role models on TV in the 70s and mm-hmm. watching Sonny and Cher and, you know, who are they going to be? Who do they want to be in this world where, you know, where they're given all those kinds of messages about, you know, what women's lives are like, or, you know, what you're supposed to look like, or.
Yeah, right. Yeah. It's unfortunately been a relevant topic of discussion for too long. Seems like we're improving, but it's a long road to go.
Gotta hope.
So I'm from the Midwest. Okay. First thing is Louisville the Midwest or the South?
Oh God. Yeah,
my friends who live there say it's the Midwest, but I've been. Some people have argued the opposite.
And I would have to say the South. You know, okay. and I say that for a lot of reasons. You know, there's a lot of Southern gentility for good and ill. You know, mm-hmm. there's the Derby and all those traditions, but there's also an existing sort of polite racism that has been at the center of our life in Louisville forever, mm-hmm. which has just been set afire by the killing of Breonna Taylor.
Yeah.
So these people who tolerated and lived with this sort of polite racism and this sort of really distinct segregation between, you know, we have what we call the Ninth Street Divide, where a lot of African Americans live beyond Ninth Street and a lot of white people live in the other direction. And so these things that we tolerated forever, you know, really exploded with the killing of Breonna Taylor. And I got to watch a lot of friends and neighbors take to the street, you know, in good conscience and say, this will not stand, mm-hmm. you know, this will not stand. So I think of Louisville as a Southern city. I really, really do. And these stories have a particular Southern flavor, although, you know, Louisville's our main urban center, politically more progressive, our arts and culture are thriving. We don't, you know, we don't share a lot in common with the rest of the state. And
So I was going to ask the annoyingly broad question then of, first of all, how long you've been in Louisville, and second, you know, in what, how grounded is your writing in place and like where you are currently? Is it, you know, is it like more of a primary focus, kind of like Sherwood Anderson and keeping things in, you know, a particular town or?
Interesting. Yeah, I've been in Louisville most of my life. I lived briefly in Cincinnati. I lived in Lexington, Kentucky for a short time. Got a master's in communications at University of Cincinnati and lived up there. But I've really lived here most of my life, and my husband has too. We lived like really close to each other and in the same neighborhood. And I would say, you know, places. Certainly place is important to this short story collection, you know, because it's this small town and these people are what really I'm doing is peeling back the veneer on these various neighbors and, you know, that sort of thing. But, you know, my next couple of books are the novels that I'm working on are set in completely different places. So I've got a story that's an alternate tale between the mother of a son with past life memories and the soldier whose memories the son actually has. So that's set in alternately in Vietnam, Missoula, Montana, and DC.
What a fascinating subject. There's that story of the young boy who remembered a past life as like a World War II pilot. And I'm sure you've researched these, but it's such a fascinating subject that I feel like should be explored more. So I'm really excited that that's what you're working on.
Oh, it was incredible. And I heard an NPR story on it. And at first I wrote a short story and it was all on the mother and the family. And I took it to the Antioch Writers Workshop in Ohio. And the instructor there, Aaron Flanagan, a fantastic writer, said to me, you know, I think this could be a book. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, wow, and who do we need in here? We need the soldier whose stories are told. And so, And then the second book I'm working on is set in Hawaii. It's a female astronomer from Cleveland who leaves her mother behind. Her mother's got ALS and she goes to Hawaii. There's a celestial discovery. There's a romance with a local surfer who happens to be a protester against the building of telescopes on top of the mountains.
Wow.
So instant kind of conflict.
So those are both quite departures, I guess, from, I mean, it's not a departure entirely. It's just, I'm curious to know how you go from, I mean, I understand maybe somebody saying a short story deserves to be a novel. And so you can kind of think of it that way, but that's quite a leap.
It is quite a leap. It's been quite an adventure just trying to figure out how to do all that work, you know, how to move those mountains, because it feels like mountains. I would say both of those really were started by news ideas. I heard that story about past life memories, and then I heard a story about a celestial object that they weren't sure if it was a comet or an asteroid. And so I really just went with those. And
I think I actually remember that.
Yeah.
Kind of mind-blowing thing they found in I forget the name, a very long name that starts with an O, but
right, a Hawaiian word. Yeah, that's it. That's the total inspiration for that. So just kind of feeling my way with those. So but I would say, you know, more than place, although I hope I nailed place in this story.
You did.
More than place, I think emotional landscape is where I go to tell the stories. And you know, I just wrote a thing that I put up on Medium about how I had a guy in my graduate class who thought that breastfeeder, so who came up to me after I read it at a seminar and said, did that happen? And I just thought, really, you're kidding me. You know, nobody goes up to Tobias Wolff and asks if he's ever been shot in the head or over the brain. You know, I mean, I just thought, wait a minute. You know, so I just wrote a thing on Medium about female writing and the degree to which people want to attribute it to autobiography. Mm-hmm. But what I will say is emotional landscape is the landscape I'm most concerned with. And so for me, what I tell people when they talk about the ring of authenticity that the stories have is that the emotions are very real. Those are really based on, you know, loneliness I've experienced or sadness, but the scenarios are fictional, you know, and it is, as you said, that radical act of empathy, you know, that I'm going to take this thing that happened to me that felt like this, and I'm going to, you know, imagine my way into this other thing and apply those feelings there, you know, mm-hmm. trying to put you in that body. And so that's what I'm most concerned with, really. And the degree to which, you know, the degree to which people can associate then with what you've written, they can connect with it. And, you know, to some extent, the function that it has for me, cathartic, you know, it's catharsis, it's processing of different psychological states. It's all of that stuff. And mm-hmm. that's been incredibly useful to me over and above whoever picks it up and sees it or identifies with it or doesn't. You know, that's served me in a particular sort of way. So,
mm-hmm. No, that makes sense. I'm actually curious about the Medium article because I had an experience recently where a friend of mine published, a female friend of mine, like published a story with, I think, similar subject matter, but essentially it was, described as like maybe vulnerable or whatever. And then I had another friend say, wow, that's like so brave to put that out. And then it got me thinking, like, why are you assuming that it's an act of bravery? Because it must just be because you believe that because it's related to like pregnancy or something, that it must be about her life. Where I was like, I can write a story and no one would ever tell me that I'm being like extremely vulnerable or brave about right. like depression or something. So I picked up on that, like, and I would love to hear about your thoughts and where that Medium article came from.
Yeah. I mean,
to clarify, just like attributing an autobiographical component to something that a woman writes about womanhood is kind of strange.
It is really strange. And, you know, here's the thing. I mean, jokingly, I say, you know, I expect it from my family. Like, I have sisters and you know, they want to mine my stuff and say, oh, I think that's from this and blah, blah, blah. Because they can't really imagine that I can do what I can do. And that's fine. That's family, whatever. But yeah, in general, I do think women get saddled with a lot of that, you know, which essentially sort of discounts the artistry of what you've achieved, mm-hmm. you know? And so really, you know, the article came out of being really pissed off that this guy said that to me. I mean, at first I thought, well, clearly something's not working up there. He really does not make putting the pieces together or whatever. But you know, I see this as a thing that happens to women, you know? Mm-hmm. So it was really a function of sort of being outraged by it mm-hmm. and wanting to, you know, really wanting to say, hey, wait a minute, you know. And so I talk a little bit about, I talk about that instance and how I wanted to jokingly say to him, oh, yeah, you know, I work as a wet nurse on the weekends. Ha ha. You know, it's like, Jesus Christ, guy. And, you know, about Camus said about fiction being, you know, about what Camus said about truth and fiction, the quote, of course, escaped me right at the moment. But so I get into that, you know, but really talk a little bit about the work that Vita has done to, you know, promote women writers, and that we really need to be more open-minded as we read and not be so quick to want to attribute those kinds of things. And then, you know, and I said point blank, you know, did people ask Philip Roth about his masturbation habits?
I right. mean, you know, yeah.
It's the same stuff, right? Yeah. And then finally end it with that idea, you know, Tobias Wolff, nobody's ever asked him, you know, have you ever been shot in the head? Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah, no, it's something that's yeah. subtle, and I don't think people intentionally ask those types of questions, but yeah. I was grateful to pick up on it before I said something dumb myself, probably.
It's just tough. It's just, you know, yeah, I mean, ultimately what you want is the stuff to be, you know, looked at face value as a work of art, as yeah,
absolutely
a, yeah as a yeah as a thing that's been transformed through words and, mm-hmm. yeah.
So I'm very curious, as somebody who finds myself completely attracted and absorbed by stories,
yeah.
Is, you know, what has that experience been like for you from going from shorter stuff to something longer? Is it difficult? And what kind of lessons have you learned along the way?
Yeah, the only way I could make myself do it was with the first one, which was the past lives one, was to separate it into short segments. So I thought, okay, I'm going to write a piece of the mother story. Then I'm going to shift. I'm going to write a piece of the soldier story. And I literally wrote it, shifting perspectives back and forth, and wrote the whole thing that way.
Oh, is it the manuscript's complete?
It is complete.
Oh, yeah, great.
Got it in the hands of a couple of independent publishers, fingers crossed.
That's awesome.
The second book, I think, is more commercial, and I'm kind of seeking an agent for that one. So I did it in short segments, and I will tell you that it felt like chipping away at a mountain with nail scissors. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was hard and painful, so hard. Now, the second time I sat down to write a novel, and it's got all this Hawaii theme and all this mystery, it was just so much, it was fun. It was really fun. You know, I really found my way into the story. And as I was doing research, and stuff would show up in my research that would lead me in another direction. I mean, it was all discovery, and it felt so liberating. So, you know, what had been a really painful transition with the first one, just like, honestly, word by word, mm-hmm. you know, sentence by sentence, laying it out, became an exercise that really flowed and was really a lot of fun. So, you know, I hope that for people, I'm the same way that, I mean, I write very short. And so to be expansive is a challenge for me. And, you know, I think I found a way to extend it. These are short novels, the ones I've got, but they are novels at novel length. And so, yeah. So that was always my challenge, you know, how to expand.
Yeah. I think it's interesting too. Like I like the idea of it being writing a novel, being a process of discovery, because I know that, you know, depending on what kind of mind you have, a lot of people have fully outlined the work before they start. And so where did you start with? You had a germ of an idea about that mystery floating in space, and it just kind of.
Yeah. And it just went from there. And I'm not a person who outlines things.
Yeah. Me neither. And it always is, it seems like a daunting task.
Yeah. I can't even do it. I can't make myself do it. But I, you know, I would say with the Vietnam Past Lives book, here's how I kind of anchored myself to do it. The mother's journey was going to be the process of kind of accepting that this kid, that she wasn't going to be able to give this kid a perfect life because he's already carrying around heavy. Mm-hmm. So I was going to figure out, like, what's she going to do? What kind of an impact is this going to have on her relationships? But the soldier story, I picked a major battle in Vietnam and I put him in it. So I had it all. I knew what was going to happen on what day. So I took him from a farm in Montana to basic training over to Vietnam and then into this particular battle, which I researched extensively.
Yeah, I was going to ask, were you in the military?
No, but I spent 10 years of all the weird jobs I've had. I spent 10 years as the editor of the Patton Saber, which was the newsletter of the Patton Museum Foundation in Fort Knox, Kentucky. So I spent 10 years writing about World War II, General Patton, getting letters from old guys who had been in World War II who would talk about serving under General Patton. I mean, I'm a very much a pacifist, and yet this was a really fantastic paying job that allowed me to do writing and history and you know, really pay tribute to some fellas who had, and women who had made significant sacrifice, you know, for our country. So I felt more comfortable with that military stuff than I ever dreamed I would be. And there are great stories about Vietnam. There's a book called We Were Soldiers Once and Young that really details how these guys were just plucked out of these small towns and out of these factories and off of these farms and sent to Vietnam with no sense of what they were getting into. Mm-hmm. And it offered a really detailed view of various battles in the war. And so, yeah, so I had that as a roadmap, and that was fantastic because I knew that on one day he's going to be here and then they're going to march down to here. And, you know, so all of that's as close as I came to having an outline. Was that.
Yeah. Mm. Good. That's refreshing to know that that can be done just with the germ of an idea, as opposed to plotting everything out from the beginning, which seems tedious and boring to me. So
me too. I just don't work that way. My mind doesn't work that way.
So when was Lost Girls published?
So June of 2020. So
June of 2020. Okay.
In the midst of the pandemic.
Right? In the midst. How'd the publication go? I mean, did the pandemic kind of make it a strange experience? And you'd published before, right? You have an initial book, Surrender, I think it's called.
Yeah, I have a chapbook of poetry, a very small one. And I've got another poetry chapbook coming in July from Seven Kitchens Press called Abide.
Oh, great. I actually didn't know that those were works, or that was a work of poetry. So you dabble in both. That's great. So,
yeah, poetry. Yeah. So it was tough. You know, for one thing, the press that I went with, I'm kind of impatient, and I went with a very small press. I had digital arcs. I didn't have paper arcs. Mm-hmm. I didn't have the support of a real support of a promotional team. I didn't have any of that. I did have years of experience promoting the work of other artists. And so that really helped me, but it was disappointing. You know, it was disappointing because I didn't get to do, I did a virtual launch with Carmichael's Bookstore, my local independent, a lot in conversation with Lee Martin, the writer Lee Martin. And that was fantastic, but it wasn't comparable to a room full of friends and family and curious onlookers or whatever, like you'd get in normal life. So that was tough. It took me forever to get the book into the hands of the right reviewers. So it was September or October before I got significantly reviewed, you know, in a way that would let people know that this was a book worth paying attention to. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that sort of thing. I mean, that was very tough, you know, and that was all stuff I had to do on my own. So, I mean, I literally, because my ability to focus significantly on anything because of COVID was so poor, I literally made this was sort of my full-time gig for months mm-hmm. and months, was getting a book out there and sort of paying attention to what other writers I knew had done promotion-wise, and just reaching out, as I did to you, to say, hey, I wonder if you'd be interested, I'd love to talk. And mm-hmm. So that's been it for me, you know, but I have to say, I'm very pleased with the results. You know, I've worked very hard, and I've had an opportunity to talk to a lot of folks about it, and it's been great. And it's these kinds of conversations about the nuts and bolts of writing that are really sustaining to me, over and above whatever happens with the book, who finds it, who doesn't find it, whether they like it or not. You know, this has been a great, I'm learning more about myself as a writer and what I was doing with this as I'm sitting in conversation with other writers. Mm-hmm. And so that's been the real pleasure of it all. Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of the pleasure of doing this too, is stealing all of your secrets and trying to use them to become a better writer. From what I've read of you so far, it's you have such a unique voice, and I've really enjoyed your work, and I'm so excited about these two novels that you have coming out. I'm gonna, you know, I hope we keep in touch, and you can, you know, let me know. Maybe we can have another discussion about writing the novel as opposed to the short story, but I would love to read your stuff and let me know where they're getting. Yeah, where's the first manuscript? Do you have a publisher for that yet?
I don't. I've got it in the hands of a couple people right now, and then I've just queried some agents on the second one. So I'm hopeful. You know, it's tough. It's just tough to find the right place. But again, I'm hopeful. It's a very unique idea, and I think it's well executed. We'll see. Mm-hmm.
It sounds extremely unique, and that could be a whole separate podcast about querying agents and all. I have no idea. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It seems so daunting, but
it is.
But your work deserves a great home, and I hope that it goes well. And thanks so much for taking the time to talk and. On this wonderful Sunday morning. It was a great, nothing better than sitting around talking about how to write a good story. So
absolutely. Thanks so much. And I'll stay in touch. Take care.
All right. Have a great Sunday.
You too.
All right, everybody. Thanks for listening to that episode with Ellen Burkett Morris. She is wonderful. And check the description of the episode for the workshop she's teaching through Hidden Timber Books about how to end a story. If her collection, Lost Girls, is any indication, she is going to teach you quite a bit. So find the link in the bio and links to her work. Really appreciate you listening. Next week, we've got an interview with Courtney Marie Andrews, Grammy-nominated musician, and she's also a poet. We talk about songwriting, poetry, her new work, Old Monarch. I also recently recorded with Gary L. Lutz, which I'm very excited about. She's got a new collection from SFLD coming in April called Worsted, and check out her previous short story collections. You can get the collected Gary L. Lutz from New York Tyrant. And let me just put it this way. Gary L. is like nobody you've read before. And in that episode, we discuss how and why that is. So very excited to share that with you and the world. Thanks as always for your support. Please leave a review on iTunes if you have some time. It would be very helpful. All the best. Talk to you soon.